another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host and friend, Bob Scott, former co-founder of the Kansas City Fellowship and the author of three books. The latest is Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and the International House of Prayer. Bob, it's good to be back and to dive a bit deeper into this Pentecostal history.
We talked about it further back, right?
Absolutely. We talked about it some last time. My method of searching these things is I'm very meticulous. I'll go backwards and then I'll go through all of the rabbit trails. Maybe I won't finish the rabbit trails, but then I go back a level and back a level. So you have to kind of reel me in whenever I start talking. I get a little bit bound to the subject at hand, but I have... we were talking offline before this, and I have studied back as far back as you want to go, because I was looking at Pentecostalism as well, and we were taught in Branhamism, we were taught this is a new thing, Branham brought it, it was brand new, he's the revealer of the written word, the spoken word, he said it, and then you find out, no, he copied half of his stuff from the guy before him, and then I investigated that guy, well, he got it from the guy before him, or cross-pollinated through some other guys. Right. And this spider web went, where I ended up actually was I went all the way back to Irenaeus. I was reading through some of the sects that he mentioned in Against Heresies, and it was really weird for anybody who has the gumption to go through that book. It's a difficult read, but I read it chapter by chapter and what I would have to do because I didn't understand what he was saying. He's speaking to an audience that understands the things he's talking about, not a modern audience. So I had to go through Wikipedia and other sources to find who in the heck is he talking about and what do they believe.
Right.
Well, come to find out, long story short, many of the things that he had dubbed as heresy way back centuries ago, millennia ago, they were coming forth as new ideas in the modern world. So these heresies are just basically resurrecting themselves. So you have this weird mixture of Gnosticism, but Pentecostalism's a bit interesting because not all of them will claim the secret knowledge, the secret gnosis. So you have some groups that are somewhat benign. You have others that go into extremism, and they're the ones who all say we have the hidden mysteries. That's what birth things like IHOP KC, Mike Bickle, etc. So you have that group, but then you have this broad swath of different holiness groups that some of them are quite weird that are the background to the birth of modern Pentecostalism. So it's a broad subject. I know we'll be all over the place. I don't know if we'll finish.
Well, it's like that diagram you showed the other day. Well, I think I said this in one of the podcasts. One of my buddies, when we were doing genealogy, goes, I don't have a family tree. I got a family weed. And I feel somewhat like, you know, the various sects and religions, not the sects and denominations within the Christian banner are like that. There's just... I saw the other day when I was doing some research, there were like 40,000 Christian denominations. So yes, to your point, we all come from somewhere. You know, that's one of the sort of fallacies that kind of gets under my skin a little bit about the marketing in the modern church world, because it's always presented as though this brother has a new revelation, or he's got a new, and when you unpack the clothes, you know, you get under the clothes, like the words or the diagram, it's the same concept that somebody had hundreds of years ago, and there's really nothing new under the sun. It's just repackaged differently. Like, we all kind of claim, like, we think we're, you know, on the cutting edge of something, and you realize, no, actually, there was somebody 500 years ago that already came up with that idea. You know, you're just saying it in a different way. You know, it's like Rick Warren's book, you know, The Purpose-Driven Life, you know, which everybody thought was, you know, it still is like the number one selling Christian book. And I was like, oh, Rick's so brilliant, except for he stole everything from all the business consultants in the non-Christian world and just put Christian terms to it. But there's like nothing original in there. It's, you know, it's like all the consulting guys in my world are like, wait a minute, we've been we've been preaching that in the business world for years. What's he doing?
Yeah.
You know, he just put Jesus on it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the funny part about it is when I was reading Against Heresies, I was, number one, I was shocked because I'm hearing things that I grew up with and believed it was a divine mystery from God that had been condemned way back then. But the thought suddenly hit me, you know, that there are some very weird beliefs in here. And to the average Christian who's never heard of any of this stuff, they would look at this and kind of scratch their head and say, no, that's a little bit weird and odd. And we're not going to be that eccentric. And those are the ones that we would call cold and formal, which is kind of funny. But then I started digging into Pentecostalism itself. And the one layer that I do want to peel back, which is closer to our timeline, is the fact that in the Pentecostal movements and the all the way to the NAR, the movements that developed off of the Pentecostals, they don't really think about the history and how odd some of it is. And I want to say that with a caveat, if you are more towards the Pentecostal side than the NAR side, there's a pride in being odd. You think that we're odd because we're different, because we're holy, etc. I lived in the same mindset. But you don't think about things like the holy kickers. These are people who are kicking for God. You see Pentecostals and you see the holy runners. They're running around the building, and that's a little bit frowned upon in the NAR churches. But they had kicking, they had punching, they had the holy jumpers. And what's really odd about this, I have not went too far with it yet. I intend to. But William Joseph Seymour, before he went to Azusa Street and the revival broke out, he went to different holiness groups that eventually would evolve into modern Pentecostalism. And he went to the more extremist sects, like Alma White's group, the holy, what were they? They were the holy jumpers, I think. They were either holy jumpers or laughters, but they were seen as eccentric for their time, but they were doing things that just was religious ecstasy and calling the ecstasy the Holy Spirit. The reason that's important, if you go back to read what Irenaeus said, he's talking about all of the religious ecstasies that were involved in the pagan religions and how the pagans were bringing this into Christianity and calling it the Holy Spirit. And he says, no, this is, we don't have this religious ecstasy as a Holy Spirit. We have something better.
Yeah, because what he's referring to, which of course, now, something that, again, I'm going to ADD here and go a little sidebar, but one of the things that is difficult, I think, for most, even modern-day Christians and Americans in particular, is they're not really versed on history. So therefore, when they read their Bibles, they don't read it in the context of the time, the culture, the sociology, right? They just take these events or these experiences and they're not contextualized. And so what he's talking about is that every ancient civilization had prophets, had people who, and in the ancient world, a prophet was always someone who represented the gods, right? So in the case of the Jewish people, they were monotheistic, so they represented, they were prophets for Yahweh, right? But you get into the Greek and the Roman and other cultures, and there's multiple gods. So you had prophets for very, you know, for all these different gods. And one of the things that was always kind of common amongst these prophetic people were these ecstasies, or as you called it, right? These, I'll give you an example that, you know, the Greeks, you know, the Greek kings and rulers, before they went to war, right? They went to see the virgins, the prophetesses, right? To get divination, right? And of course, years later, what did they figure out? They figured out this temple was sitting on top of gas, right? Yeah. And so these basic virgin prophetesses were all high all the time, right? But that was a common thing. It was a common thing that, you know, that these people who spoke for God, you know, would have these weird manifestations all the time. In some cases, if you analyze it based on modern medicine, you would say some of these people could have been epileptic, right? They had seizures, and because people that have had epileptic seizures have had, you know, what could be defined as these mystical experiences, right? Because they go into a different realm. So it's so interesting to me, because as when I'm looking at it, what I see in many ways, if I unpack the religiousness of it, I just see human nature. And what I mean by that is, as humans, we're basically a combination of two pieces, emotions and reason, right? Those are the two kind of driving things in our life. Well, you're evangelicals who believe that, you know, the manifestations of the Holy Spirit ceased with the apostles. They focused on the reason side of it. So you've had, you know, 2,000 years of we just focus on the scriptures, right? But there's this other side of us as humans that's very emotional, and we want an experience, right? And so there's always been this hunger in people to want to have intimacy with God, to relate to God, to feel like God's talking to them, right? This emotion, you know, they want to have an emotional experience. And so in some ways, to me, Pentecostalism and the whole experience-driven religious experience is driven by the fact that we as humans want emotional experiences, right? It's like a need we have. And so there's a certain vulnerability in that we all have, because we want to believe. And I saw that early on with KCF, when suddenly as a 25-year-old, I got three guys who the Pentecostals are all telling me are prophets, right? And I'm watching people, and it's like, this is interesting. The energy level when we're having Bible study is not the same when we can go to a meeting and have an experience where our emotions are all stimulated, right? And it's like, okay, this is interesting. So I understand, you know, it's like I'm trying to humanize this, right? It's not just heresy and all that. It's just, it's human nature. We want to experience God, and we want to be heard. Like, I have to say, some of the most moving experiences, we're watching people who did get what we could call words right, where somebody spoke to something deep in their soul that no one else knew about. And the look on people's faces and the tears that came down their cheeks was like, oh my God, God sees me. Right, it's like he hears me. Like I'm not a nobody. Like he sees. Like it just, there's an ecstatic feeling that people have. Like, wow, you know what I mean? And I get it. Like I really get it. There's a human side to this that I don't want to lose in all of our, you know, analyzing it all. But there's always been these two parallel roads, right? The academic, scripture, theology, and then this other thing. Oh, does God see me? Can I have an experience with him?
Yeah. And there's, I want to go back to something you said. You're talking about the Oracle of Delphi.
Yeah.
And I have seen the National Geographic videos where they're going and looking at the gas chamber. I think it's methane gas.
Methane gas, yeah.
They were as high as a kite, man.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's no telling what come out of their mouth. Well, there's an aspect of this that the different types of Christianity view differently. And one of the things that I see in common, which is I'm not going to say it's a flaw, but it is a potential for disaster if carried too far in the Pentecostal charismatic movement. And that is the idea that we as Christians should over-spiritualize things. And where I'm headed with this is the Oracle of Delphi and beyond. There are Bible passages talking about, why are you worshiping the idols made of stone? And what does this mean? These are only stone. Why are you worshiping stone, right?
Right. Right.
But there's this idea to say that all of the ancients, when they were worshiping the idols, they were actually demons in those deities, and those evil deities were down and causing, wreaking havoc. Well, that's not what the apostles said. Those are stone guys. Come on, don't worship the stones.
Yeah, they're inanimate objects.
Yeah, exactly. I have mentioned Hero. I think it's Hero of Alexandria, if I remember correctly. It's Hero or Heron. He was an architect who went around to the temples, and he made these idols of stone, brass, gold, different idols come alive through hydraulics and pneumatics and crazy stuff. And they have uncovered one of his notebooks with partial pages, and they can see how he did some of this. And it's some crazy cool things. So we had an architect in the ancient world who is making the demons be much like you would see if you went to an amusement park and saw the statues moving next to the ride that you're riding. But in the ancient world, the average person didn't understand hydraulics or pneumatics or magnetism. They thought, oh my gosh, this is alive. Fast forward to the Native Americans. They saw the first vehicle. Well, my gosh, this stagecoach is traveling with invisible horses. You know, when your first thought is going to be your perspective, and your perspective is skewed by your knowledge. The problem is, whenever you have things like the Oracle of Delphi, who is projecting prophecies high on gas, you can't really say that that's a demonic force. You could say, maybe Satan's involved because of this.
It's just keep it simple, stupid.
It's just high as a kite, right?
Yeah.
But the end result is this. There are Christians who don't look at it over-spiritualized. They will think with a little bit of history, common sense, and culture and say, yeah, they were high as a kite, and that wasn't worship of God, and right. We had the real worship of God. But then you've got some of the more extreme Pentecostal sects that will say, well, that was a demon force in the Oracle of Delphi, and that was the false prophets, and so on and so forth. Where it gets really interesting is when the lines get blurred, and that's what was being investigated with Irenaeus and Against Heresies. The lines got blurred because some of that trickery was now coming into Christianity, and with it, many of the pagan worship practices. And those practices didn't summon actual demons. They were, like the apostles said, these are idols made of stone. You can't resurrect a stone and make it a demon.
Well, to your point, this is something that, I guess I'm kind of opening up a little bit here, because I was 25 years old when KCF started, right? So, and I was new to all this, but one of the things that you're talking about that I remember being confronted with was everything was caused by a demon. And I remember sitting there going, no, he just got a bad attitude. you know what I mean? It was like always this kind of thing, like it was this other being's fault. It was all right. It was like, no, that person lied. No, that person stole. No, that person's a drug addict. Like there was this thing within the Pentecostal circles where you didn't take personal responsibility because it was a devil. It was a demon, right? It was like something else was driving it. We couldn't just say, no, I'm selfish, or no, I have pride, right? It's like, no, it was, it was the influence of this devil on them.
I look at it like it's the adult version of the kid who gets his hand caught in the cookie jar and says, the devil made me do it.
Flip Wilson for our generation. The devil made me do it. But yeah, that was always kind of an interesting thing to me. And there was a guy that even came to our church named Howard Pittman, who was out of Texas or whatever, and he had died. And I mean, he had this book about frog demons and this demon, like, and all these, like, because when he died, this is what he saw, right? And you're just like, holy cow, wow. You know, and again, I don't want to step on people's toes or insult anybody, because there's clearly evil in the world. I mean, there is And there are, all of us have felt darkness and creepy feelings and like this sense of something, right? So it's like, wow, there's something here. There's a presence of something, right? Whatever, you know, and you could call it whatever you want. But I think like so many things within Pentecostalism, it just goes to such extreme. It goes from, you know, something to everything. You know, and it's like everything is a demon now, and so that got my head spinning, right? Because it was just for a while there, I was like, "Wow, this is crazy!" Like these demons are busy little guys, you know? They're just doing everything. Like, what, you know? Are we humans? Do we like have any responsibility here? Mm-hmm. The other thing was we were talking about, and I think this is. Again, I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but that's okay. I'm at that age now. I don't even really care anymore. But one of the things that I had the privilege of doing, which really was a life changer for me in terms of perspective, was in the mid-1980s, I had the privilege of meeting Dr. Israel Stockman, who was Israel's leading anthropologist. I toured all of Israel for a week with Dr. Stockman. I learned Israel not from all the little church tours, you know, where they go to all the holy sites. I learned the history of the people. I mean, we went everywhere. And one of the things that just was a mind-boggling statement that he made is he said, "You American Christians, because you have no understanding of my people's journey or where we came from, and you just read the Bible in your little religious silos, you don't understand that there's virtually nothing in the Bible or in our culture that's original with us." And I was like, what? And in my brain, Moses, right? I grew up with this belief that Moses, you know, got the Ten Commandments, and these were all new. Like, this was Moses introducing all these principles, you know, for the first time to humanity, only to discover from Dr. Stockman, no, the Mesopotamians did this hundreds of years earlier, yeah. Right? And there's virtually nothing in the Ten Commandments that the Mesopotamians didn't have in their law codes. And we know this because we have archaeological evidence with it all written down on clay tablets, right? And you're like, oh, right? But to your point here, it's like the whole concept of prophets, you know? Well, you know, the Israelis were, the Hebrews were just copying what everybody else was doing. They came out of everywhere else, right? Abraham came out of Mesopotamia, right? They don't even become a culture until the time of David. Before that, they're wandering tribes of herdsmen that nobody takes serious. And that's one of the things I find fascinating, because when people read the Bible, they think of Israel, and Israel, you know, this force, right? And we see it, you know, because again, what's our perspective? Well, Jesus came from here, and right? But in the ancient world, like, they were nobodies. Like, nobody cared. The Egyptians, the Assyrians, the Mesopotamians, the Babylonians, they were somebodies, right? Like, you know, they were the Hebrews were like the country bumpkins, you know, like the people from over there, right? The dirty livestock handlers.
Not many people will agree with this, and I'll cause all kinds of a ruckus, but I've studied also before Jesus came, and some of the ancient world, many of the ancient cultures, many of the ancient codes of conduct, laws, code, etc., the ancient Near East code. And you can find scholars who will admit this, and you will find Christian scholars, some of them, who will debate this. You'll find that there's this small group of Christian scholars that will agree that it is plausible, and some of them will go so far as to admit it. But whenever you're talking about the children of Israel, they came out of Egypt. Egypt had all of their worship, etc. Right. What's interesting about this, sitting in, I think it's the library that's in London, England. I'd have to go back and confirm this. But in this library is a statement made by the Egyptians. Whenever they died, they would write these burial statements. So they've uncovered this, right? With the coffin.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Well, in one of these, which predates the Old Testament by 2,000 years, they found actual documentation from a dying person with each of the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. Now, there was more than this, but the Egyptian Code of Conduct had this. The Pentecostal movement, the more extreme versions of Pentecostalism, I should say, they have this idea of good and evil in such a way where the other side can't have any good. Mm-hmm. And yet, if you go back and you look through some of the ancient cultures, many of the things that the Israelites had, the other cultures did have. And it was that knowledge, when I came across that, I realized that I'm not understanding the Mosaic Law correctly. Why? Mm-hmm. And so I started diving deeply into this, and I found that there's all kinds. Mosaic Law is, it'd be like our Constitution. This is our civil law. This is our religious law, ceremonial mm-hmm. law, right down to here's how you keep mold from growing in your hut. They've got so many different things. And not all of it was meant to be religion. But in the more extreme sects of Pentecostalism, they will read each one of those statements made in the Old Covenant verbatim as though it applies today. Mm. And we don't live under that constitution. We have a different constitution. Mm. So it's not even applicable. But when you frame it in such a way where it is good or evil, demons and Satan or God, you really lose context of what the thing means. And so your Bible means something different to you than it does the other Christians. Mm-hmm. And the point I'm trying to drive at is the people that you're talking about who are reading it, and they say many of these things existed, predated us. Well, the same thing existed before the Pentecostal movement, but they've right. lost focus over time of what it meant yeah. to be a Christian.
Well, one of the things Dr. Stockman said to me, he goes, well, if you really want to know the truth about my people, he goes, we're master tweakers.
Yes.
And I go, what? And he goes, well, it's like this. He goes, you think we were the originators of animal sacrifice? He goes, that was like going on, right? He goes, what we did is in all the other cultures, the priests got on the altar with the sacrifice. We decided that the sacrifice was holy unto God, so the priest wasn't allowed on the altar. We tweaked it. He goes, we took other cultures, and we integrated it into what we're doing, and we just put a uniquely Hebrew slant to it, right? My point here in all this is that dynamic that we're talking about, that's been going on for thousands of years. That's why, you know, modern Pentecostalism, there's a tree that goes all the way back, right? So it's like the prophets of old. Well, you think prophets were unique to the Hebrew people?
Yeah.
Right? Like, no, they were more non-Hebrew prophets than prophets. And then what's even crazier about the Hebrew prophets, in the modern world, the way people think now, most of them would be considered anti-Semitic because of the fact they were so against all the Jewish leaders, right? Like they were condemning over and over and over again, right? Now, the one thing, though, that I think, because this gets into a whole nother question, which we can delve into or save it for another episode, is what's a prophet, right? Because when you go back, you know, and when you see prophetic through the Pentecostal model, it's spiritual revelation, right? But in the ancient world, you had that kind of thing too, right? You had prognostication and, you know, different things like that. But most of the Old Testament prophets weren't prognosticators. They were plumb line guys. They were like saying, hey, wait a minute, this is our standard, or this is God's standard, and you've deviated. You're a liar. You're a cheater. You're a manipulator. You're dishonest. You know, you did this. You know, that they were being held to account, right? So that's where it kind of gets interesting to me, because I think one of the downsides of Pentecostal prophets is I think we've narrowed the definition of what's prophetic down to this very narrow thing. So in my mind, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who most people probably don't even remember, who was a Russian dissident who taught at Harvard, I think he was prophetic. He warned way back in the 1970s. He gave a speech there that most people don't even remember, where he told America, this is what you're going to do. He said, you think that freedom is your most important value, but I guarantee that when you're confronted with your security, you will compromise your freedom to feel safe. And blah, blah, blah. Like he warned, like, and all these things that he warned about in the 1970s have come to be true. Now, did he speak for God? You know, did he have a revel? You know, it's like, you see what I mean? But he was very prophetic in what he said. And there's been all kinds of people like that in our culture where they have held up a plumb line and said, hey, you know what I mean? Here's what it should be, and here's what we're not doing. But we discount them because of the fact they didn't speak in tongues. You know, they didn't say, God showed me, I had a dream, you know what I mean? It's like they just say it. They just get to the meat of the message, which is what you see in the, you know, in so much of the Old Testament. You know, it's just, here's the meat.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. So here's one of the interesting facts that I have researched, and that podcast will come out, I think, before this one, but I did dive a bit into the Pentecostal Azusa Street Revival and afterwards the shaping of it as it relates to money. And I want to talk about that briefly, because what we're talking about is how Pentecostalism got shaped in the way that it did, and you can trace it all the way back to the ancient world. But there is a difference, and I think the difference is significant for people to think through. We talked last time in our podcast about the succession between William Joseph Seymour, who was trained under Charles Fox Parham, who went to Zion City and went to Frank Sanford's cult in Maine before he started his Bethel group in Kansas. And in the Kansas group, that's where you had the writing in tongues, which eventually became speaking in tongues. He moved to Houston. He trained William Joseph Seymour, and Seymour went out to Los Angeles. So that background having been said, there's an aspect of this that not many people think through. And that is the aspect of whenever there is fear, especially fear of the end of days, combined with a very charismatic person, regardless of the different way in which he presents religion, people seem to be very willing to open up their pocketbooks, and then it becomes this vicious cycle of feeding the beast. William Joseph Seymour, by almost all accounts, is a completely poor, very humble, very kind man with nothing bad to say about him. And I'm not going to say anything bad about him, but it's the system he got caught up in, and that system pre-existed him. Yeah. When he was walking through Azusa Street, people were stuffing $5 and $10 bills in his pockets, and he had, this is coming from not even the critical newspapers, from Pentecostal historians, though we'll talk about this. If you do the money translation of what $5 to $10 was back then, these are bills of up to $380-something dollars that is being stuffed in his pocket. And the revival went on for months and months. So if you got a bunch wad of cash in your pocket at night, you're going to take it out of your pocket, which means the pockets likely kept being filled, and there was a large sum of money flowing through it. I'll just say it like that. Did that make him rich? I don't know. I'm not going to say, but he was in a system that enabled this. And again, he came out of the training from Charles Fox Parham, who had all kinds of money-making schemes. He was going to take over Zion City. He was an investor or a director in a company that allegedly could turn ordinary rocks into gold through this elixir from God.
Right.
But before him, he was, like I said, he went to Frank Sanford's sect. Frank Sanford was out of the Christian and Missionary Alliance, led by A.B. Simpson. I have done extensive research on Simpson, and the amount of money flowing through that organization is kind of crazy. We're talking tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars, because he was saying that we, as Christian missionaries, we need to form an alliance so that we can spread the gospel to the world, because the world is about to end. And if we can do this quickly, if we can raise enough money to do this, we will usher in the coming of the second coming of Jesus Christ. That's a theme that got replicated. We need to do this so Christ will come, and therefore give me your money in the tithe basket.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think as we've talked offline, even before the 1900 explosion of Pentecostalism in the late 1800s, you had, and we were talking about that one episode about upstate New York, right, where you had Charles Finney revivals, you know, Joseph Smith getting his revelation that ends up starting the Latter-day Saints movement. You have the spiritualist movement, you know, Harry Houdini trying to, you know, whatever. And then you got the Brethren, right? You know, which came out of England. Was that John Darby or whatever? And again, to your point, the end times, you know, God's coming back, right? So there's a precursor, I mean, Pentecostalism just didn't pop out of nowhere. It had its roots in decades before, right? Well, then, you know, I kept asking myself, well, what happened before that? Like, what was happening before the Civil War? Like, what was happening in colonial America, right? Well, then you start thinking about names like the Shakers, right? And the Quakers, you know, who were Pennsylvania, some of those, right? Again, people wanting to have an emotional, experiential kind of Christian experience. And that whole thing again about, you know, that getting that knowledge, that download from heaven, you know, getting some sort of revelation. So you have those guys. But it even goes farther back. I was doing some research and realized that, you know, the Eastern Orthodox, you know, they had a whole group of monastic guys, you know, that were all believed they were hearing from God in the fourth century. There was a whole mystical movement that historians call the heresy of the free spirit, right? And again, groups deviating from Catholicism, right? The ritualism of the Catholic experience, wanting to, you know, hear from God. Then you had the Apostolic Brethren in the 13th century, right? There's another whole group. Before them, there's this group called the Americans. And then, of course, you know, you can just keep going back, you know, the Cathars, the Bogomils, there's all these names. When you start digging, you realize that almost every generation or every century, right, has a group of people who believe in these extra biblical, we'll call it that, when I mean outside of, I don't mean it's outside the Bible, I mean it's just not studying the word, it's experience, all the way back to your guy Irenaeus, who is fighting who? Montism, right? I mean, Monta, what was his name, the guy that started the whole movement, I mean, that's all he had was prophetesses, right? And as we were talking, what ends up happening, which is so interesting, because our normal Christianity is centered around the Bible, right? Well, there wasn't that for 300 and some years of Christianity. There wasn't, let's go to the Bible, right? In fact, the reason why we now go back to the Bible, as we said, is because poor Constantine is trying to figure out what in the heck is the truth, because there are so many groups that all have prophets and prophetesses or having secret knowledge, that there is so many different versions of, by, you know, the 300, or, you know, early 300s, of what Jesus said, what the apostles said, what the truth is. It's insane, right? That's why you get, you know, you get the early, what they call the early church fathers, is because they're arguing now against all these experience-driven cults or sects of Christianity. They're fighting, you know, they're, guys, it's people don't understand that early Christianity is wild, wild west. It's not anything like what we know today. It's just complete chaos.
And, you know, it wasn't until, what was the year, 1945, when they discovered the caves, the Qumran caves, where all of the scripts were. They had no idea how widespread Christianity was and how different varying the beliefs were. And they suddenly discovered all of these scrolls, and here's all of these people believing these different things. Interestingly, within all of this, I don't know if you know this or not, the book of Revelation is one that barely made it into the canon.
Yeah.
There were some things
about it. That's pretty wild. That's kind of like a drug experience.
Well, and the reason why, it didn't really match the rest of the books in its style and literature. And they thought maybe it was Gnostic influenced, which they later learned it really wasn't. There were parts of it that were, but the book as a whole wasn't. But what they thought, it was unique, and that was... I don't know if that was the deciding factor, but you can read through some of the reasons why it was accepted. And bottom line is this, it wasn't until 1945 that we realized that it wasn't that dissimilar to other groups. Basically, you had these groups that were into these divine mysteries, and they had their own prophetic figures. They had what the NAR has today, but they weren't considered the Orthodox Christian. They were something else, right? So these developed over time in different ways. And the idea that we have the secret knowledge of the coming destruction, that was prevalent once you reached after Christianity, once the Gnostics got involved. Fast forward into the Keswickian movement in the UK. So this is one that would have been late 1700s, early 1800s, and they believed that you got the second blessing, which is very similar to what came out of Pentecostalism. Why? Because when Charles Fox Parham was trained under Frank Sanford had a connection, a theological connection, to the Keswickian movement, the higher life movement. And so you had these ideas coming in, and the weird part about all of this is Irenaeus was talking about all of these groups that tried to take the experience of receiving the Holy Spirit to an emotional level, to a different level than simply what the Bible stated about it. And they were doing different things like numerologies. There were groups that would see patterns of fives, sevens, threes, mm-hmm. and they would say, "This is holy because we have this number." And Irenaeus would go map how they came to that conclusion, usually through a pagan religion. But it's all about this. It's this idea that once you get into the gnosis, the secret knowledge, that's whenever you come to a higher plane, you come to a higher life. And the higher life movement coming into this and framing what became modern Pentecostalism is interesting, because Azusa Street really can't claim something that's brand new. You had speaking in tongues before it. You had the higher life before it, which would be the second blessing. You had so many different aspects of their belief system that it wasn't new. What was new was the fact that it was framing itself into a combined, unified, Pentecostal, maybe not denomination, but faith as it started to emerge.
Well, let me share something with you that's kind of funny. So... here I am in the middle of Dreams and Visions Central. I mean, it's like the whole culture I'm in is Dreams and Visions, right? And I had this love for Ecclesiastes. And the reason was is that growing up Catholic and then not having any religion, the very first book that I read as a new believer was Ecclesiastes. And it blew my mind. Because in reading that, I went, oh my God, whoever wrote this kind of understands life, right? So I loved Ecclesiastes. So I'm revisiting Ecclesiastes, and I come across this verse, Ecclesiastes 5:7. For in the multitude of dreams and many words, There are also diverse vanities, but fear thou God. Right? Basically, it's folly. You know, the pursuit of many dreams and visions is folly. Just respect God, right? And I thought, wait a minute, this is written like 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So even in, you know, if that was Solomon that wrote Ecclesiastes, right? Even at the time of David, right? They're in a culture where it's being, you know, they're surrounded by many dreams and visions and people seeking the Gnosis, the secret knowledge, right? And he's looking at it going, yeah, this is folly. It's vanity. And I'm like, huh. Man, some truths, you know, just pass the mustard test of time, because that was 3,000 years ago, and I've sort of come into the same conclusion here, right? So am I, now again, let me quantify this. Am I against dreams and visions? No, not at all. The key word here is the multitude, right? It's like, it's just the overwhelming, it's got to the point now for me, and this is one of my pet peeves about Pentecostalism and charismaticness. We've taken something that I think has the potential to be quite powerful and devalued it because there's too much of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not that I don't think people have, because people have, I mean, I work in the business world, and I could tell you how many conversations I've had with guys whose whole careers and the millions of dollars they make came from a spiritual experience. Literally, something just dropped out of nowhere into their head, right? You know, ideas, dreams, guys like Tesla, right? Who dream, right? So I believe there is a spiritual realm that you can tap into. So don't get me wrong. But when you create a culture where everybody is constantly saying, God said, God showed me, I had a dream, right? It's just, after a while, I just think it not only does it devalue, but it's just like people get numb. It's like, really? Right? And yet we keep falling for it. But I think when you're younger, you're a little bit more vulnerable to it. But then over the course of time, it's like, oh God, here we go again. Which is a terrible thing to say, and I don't want to be the grumpy old man here, but it's just like, oh God, you know what I mean? It's like, have I not seen this before? Wait, no, I've probably seen this 50 times. It's like, and there's some young guy up there going, thinking he's original. I'm like, oh God. But I think our whole point here is what we're trying to say is that there's a long history here, and each generation begets a generation, a next generation, and things just keep getting repeated. The only difference is the clothes you wear. I mean, it's just the way, what it's, you know, the context that it's used in. That's the only thing. But the same, you know, like you were saying, you know, there's crisis imminent. God's got to rescue us. There's same underlying fears for thousands of years are the same things that all these little supposedly prophetic people are all using to manipulate people. It's the same thing. There's nothing new here.
And the point I was driving at with the money, it's not even, so William Joseph Seymour is seen by even non-Pentecostal historians very favorably, because he really didn't have any, from all appearances, he didn't have any ambition to have great wealth or prosperity. Right. He just simply wanted to spread Charles Fox Parham's gospel. So the thing of it is, whenever you've got money involved, I'm not against the visions or the prophets either, but the problem is once money gets involved, you have to create sustainability, and it's not even for any devious purpose. Mm-hmm. They're just to build up the systems of the culture that existed later, the conventions, the revivals. Think of just simply how much it would cost to plan a tent revival. Tents were expensive back then.
Yeah.
You had to do all your advertising. If you had a large number of people who were coming in the middle of nowhere, you had to have food provisions. You had to invest money and then collect it in the tithe basket to pay for some of the costs. Some of them actually didn't make a whole lot of money. They just paid all the expenses.
Yeah.
But the problem is, once you get caught up in that system, the revenue has to continue. And for people to contribute, it has to get bigger, better, more exciting, right, more entertaining. And they're not going to come and spend a lot of money if it's not entertaining, especially the crowds that were going to the tent revivals. There were people who weren't even Christian who were coming just because that's our form of entertainment here in the rural area. Yeah. That's all we had. Yeah. So once you get into that system, now you can take good people with good ambitions, but they're in a system that enables and encourages the bigger, better, fancier, more miracles, more signs and wonders. In my opinion, what happened is it just spun out of control.
Well, I think to your point, I mean, and I use this phrase with Mike, but I call it the P.T. Barnum syndrome. And I think the Pentecostal world is just filled with it. Greatest show on earth. And I mean, it's that's the thing, right? And well, what drives that? See, this is always the question, like, what's underneath all this? It's not the prophecies problem. It's not the dreams and vision. They're a means to an end, right? It's what's underneath all this that gets me. And it's this drivenness, you know, James called it selfish ambition and greed, right? This, I call it the lust for status and stuff. And it's a common theme I have seen through my whole Christian journey with certain individuals. Their lust for status and stuff, what ends up happening is that the church world becomes a means to an end, and Pentecostalism and the whole sensational side of it actually is very appealing because it attracts people, right? It's the same concept that P.T. Barnum used when he opened his, wherever it was his big museum or what, he had his freak show, remember? And it was like, come see the crazy, you know? And people wanted to see crazy, right? I mean, you used to have people show up at up at the church just for the show. Like they, you know, they didn't even like Bob Jones or Paul. They just want to see the show, right? They just want to see, or they wanted to just see how people reacted, right? And that whole thing. So my point here is that, you know, we look at it just in the church world, but, you know, P.T. Barnum and all of the showmen out there, they're doing the same thing. Have you guys seen these mentalist guys?
Yes.
I mean, there's a guy now, he's got like a zillion videos out there, but I mean, he does sports celebrities and stuff like that. I mean, the look on people's, like, he freaks people. I can't even remember the guy's name, but he freaks people out. The way he ends up doing all this stuff, and they end up like he's already got it written down, you know, what the final answer is going to be, right? Way before everything. And somehow or another, he gets everybody there and they're like they're just blown away, right? It's a show, right? He makes money at it. It's like, it's not any different over here than it is over here. You know, it's just, we just, again, different clothes. We just put Jesus on it.
And that's one of the things. There are people who condemn all of these religious leaders who are making money and selling books, etc. But to some extent, you have to cover the cost. And especially right, once you get in the megachurch world, you've got to do something to keep the lights on. It's just such a massive right, building.
Well, that's the pressure, right?
Yeah, that's the pressure. My understanding of what Christianity should be is not that. It should be smaller communities. And
yeah, exactly.
One of the problems we had when I was growing up in the cult world, I would drive 45 minutes to an hour to go to a church that was our church, our kind of church. But I was passing by, I can't tell you how many hundreds of churches along the way, each one having a community that should have been supported internally. And I left my own community, the churches in that community. So I was really not contributing to my community. And I look at the mega churches much the same way. There are people that will drive an hour to go to a mega church. Well, what about the community that they're abandoning?
Well, you know, to your point, there's a lot that we default to thinking that it's normal, right? So it's like for so many people, well, this is just normal Christianity. Is it? You know, people don't, and we just assume like this is normal, right? Like, well, what's driving all this? Well, what's so interesting to me is that you get preachers up there talking about how we're not of this world, you know, we're of this other kingdom and blah, 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 blah. Except for when we evaluate success, we use the very same criteria that the secular world uses, right? Bigger, right? Size, you know, we're bigger and we got more money. And we have more influence. Like all the same values that we use to evaluate a secular business, we use to evaluate a church. I used to go to all these pastors' meetings. There's a pecking order, and the pecking order is based on, you know, how many people go to your church and what the size of your offering is. That was the pecking order. And I'm like, well, this is kind of wild. That has nothing to do with somebody's spiritual stature, right? Has nothing to do with the fact that, you know, that they've got this calling. It's all based on the very same value system of the secular world over here in the church world. And you're like, how'd that happen? Like, where did that creep in? And it's like, now it's our new normal. Like, nobody even challenges it anymore. And you're like, wow, we're like so far off the reservation here, because I guarantee if Jesus came back, that is not how he would evaluate anything we're doing. In fact, he probably would look at it and go, I got a problem with this.
And Paul would have to hire secretaries because there would be too many letters to go out.
No, he'd be using AI now.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Chat GPT. Yeah. I don't need a scribe anymore. I got ChatGPT.
So much to think through. I was trying to think before we got on the call, how can, it's such a broad swath of history. It's so hard to nail down any one topic. But the bottom line for me is this. You can start at any point in time, whether it's Pentecostalism, whether it's the Apostolic Reformation, you're going to find streams of history that each one is built on as they learn many things, good and bad, as they go. Yeah. Pentecostalism's not all bad. There are some good things about it. But it also incorporated things that, in my opinion, were enabling destructive natures. And that's why you had so many different Pentecostal groups spin off into destructive cults. So my point is, you have to have some sort of boundaries and guardrails to examine your belief set and make sure that it's not something that is destructive, and be able to critically think about it so that the people can avoid getting caught up into
it. Well, I think what I would like people to walk away from, so think about your experience. You guys grew up in this world where everybody thought William Branham was an original. My point here is, no, he wasn't. He was rinse and repeat. Like, in other words, there was nothing original about him. But there was a whole culture built around this personality because of this thing that somehow or another he was a forerunner. As I was got in this argument with Mike about this, we're forerunners. No, you're not. Mm-hmm. You're rinse and repeat. There's nothing new under the sun here. It's like you're not original. But again. You're not going to attract people, and you're not going to get a lot of money if you're just an echo. So you got to create this whole perception that I'm an original, that God spoke to me. And you're like, well, he spoke the same thing last generation and the one before that. Wait a minute, like the last 30 generations. it's like, I guess I go, it's rinse and repeat. But that's what gets under my skin, is a little bit. I get irritated by these guys all trying to present themselves as original spokesmen for God. And you're just going, no, you're not. There's nothing original about what you did, other than the fact you put different clothes on and you put a little different word on it, or used a little different word picture to describe it, right?
Yeah. It has all happened before. It will all happen again.
Exactly.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Okay.
If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR. And for more about Mike Bickle and IHOP KC, you can read Some Said They Blundered, Breaking My Decades of Silence on Mike Bickle, The Kansas City Prophets, and The International House of Prayer.